The Swedish flag is raised at NATO headquarters as it becomes the 32nd member of the organization.
With this membership, Sweden has come home. Home to the security cooperation of democracies. Home to the security cooperation of our good neighbors.
Plus, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Jamaica to discuss the situation in Haiti.
Right now, the gangs have united, which before they were fighting amongst themselves, but they are now united in the cause of keeping the Prime Minister from returning to Haiti.
And China wraps up its annual parliamentary meeting. Today is Tuesday, March 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Miller. As the Swedish flag was raised at NATO headquarters in Brussels, the Swedish military on Monday marked its entry into the Transatlantic Military Alliance with flag-raising ceremonies all over the country. Swedish Crown Princess Victoria led the delegation in a short yet rainy ceremony outside the glass and steel headquarters on the outskirts of Brussels, at which the Swedish anthem was being played. Speaking at the occasion, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said Sweden's ascension shows that NATO's door remains open and that no one can close it.
Every nation has the right to choose its own path, and we all choose the path of freedom and democracy.
After more than 200 years of military non-alignment, Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson called it a historic and natural step to join the transatlantic organization.
With this membership, Sweden has come home. Home to the security cooperation of democracies, home to the security cooperation of our good neighbors. Today, I'd like to say thank you to all of our allies. We have chosen you, and you have chosen us. All for one. One for all.
Sweden became NATO's 32nd member last week, 2 years after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine prompted it to rethink its national security policy. Sweden will benefit from the alliance's common defense guarantee, under which an attack on one member is regarded as an attack on all. Now, after the ceremony, Stoltenberg spoke with Reuters News and made it clear with Pope Francis's comment that Ukraine should have the courage of the white flag and negotiate an end to the war triggered by Russia's invasion.
It's not the time to talk about surrender by the Ukrainians. That will be a tragedy for the Ukrainians. It will also be dangerous for all of us.
Now, in that interview, he also distanced himself from French President Emmanuel Macron's declaration that Western allies should not rule out deploying troops to Ukraine. Stoltenberg said that even if individual NATO countries sent troops to Ukraine, that would affect the alliance as a whole, as its members are bound by a collective defense pact. Now, the event in Brussels also took place as Russia is preparing for a presidential election later this week. President Vladimir Putin is certain to win, barring any unexpected developments that will give the longest-serving Kremlin chief since Joseph Stalin another 6-year term in power. But who is in the running, and how will the voting work? Reuters' Lauren Anthony has that story.
Russia's elections are set to take place between the 15th and 17th of March. Results will follow shortly afterwards, and the winner will be inaugurated in May. Voting will also take place in what Russia calls its new territories, parts of Ukraine now controlled by Russian forces, which have been placed under Russian law. Ukraine says it will not rest until it has ejected every last Russian soldier from those annexed territories. There are 112.3 million people with the right to vote in the election. Almost 2 million people abroad can also participate, and 12,000 in a cosmodrome which Russia rents in Kazakhstan. Around 70 to 80 million people usually cast ballots. Turnout in 2018 was 67.5%. This year, a remote online voting system will also be available for the first time. Putin is running against communist Nikolai Kharitonov, Leonid Slutsky, leader of the Nationalist Liberal Democratic Party, and Vladislav Davankov of the New People Party. Boris Nadezhdin, an anti-war candidate, was barred from running, as was Yekaterina Duntsova, a former TV journalist. 71-year-old Putin, a former KGB lieutenant colonel, has already served as president for longer than any other Russian ruler since Joseph Stalin. The 1993 Russian constitution was seen by some in the West as a development that would lead to democracy in post-Soviet Russia. It originally specified that a president could only serve two terms of 4 years if they were back-to-back. But amendments in 2008 extended the presidential term to 6 years. And changes in 2020 formally reset Putin's own presidential term tally to zero from 2024, potentially allowing him to remain in power until 2036. The West cast Putin as a war criminal, a killer, and a dictator. But opinion polls at home show he has approval ratings of 85%, higher than before the invasion of Ukraine. The Kremlin says Putin enjoys overwhelming support from the Russian people and that Russia doesn't want to be lectured by the West about democracy. Russian officials say the West is trying to undermine Russia by casting doubt on the legitimacy of the election. The Russian opposition sticks to the formal rules of the tightly controlled political system. Despite having seats in parliament, it does not oppose the Kremlin on major issues. Putin's opponents, many of whom are in jail or have fled abroad, have been predicting since 1999 that turmoil will one day bring down the system over which he presides. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights said in January Russia had not invited OSCE observers to the election, calling the decision deeply regrettable. In 2018, the ODIHR said there were intense efforts to promote turnout and that citizens voted in significant numbers, but added that, quote, restrictions on the fundamental freedoms of assembly, association and expression, as well as on candidate registration, have limited the space for political engagement and resulted in a lack of genuine competition.
Lauren Anthony of Reuters News. We're also following these other stories from around the world. In a message posted on the X platform, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced his nation has successfully tested its first domestically produced missile capable of carrying multiple warheads. India has been developing its medium and long-range missile systems for several decades. The U.S. Department of the Treasury sanctioned 16 entities and individuals Monday for their role in fundraising and money laundering for the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab, which operates in Somalia, is an Islamist insurgency group with connections to Al-Qaeda. Those sanctioned in connection with the group were operating throughout the Horn of Africa, the United Arab Emirates, and Cyprus. And the 19-member cabinet of Pakistan's newly elected Prime Minister, Shahbaz Sharif, has been sworn into office. Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari administered the oath of office to the ministers. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Jamaica Monday to attend a Caribbean Community or CARICOM meeting on Haiti, where security has collapsed and a humanitarian crisis is unfolding in the Caribbean nation. Among the several items on the proposed agenda, Blinken is expected to discuss the long-awaited deployment of a multinational security mission to restore order in Haiti, which is set to be led by Kenya. Blinken later on Monday announced that the United States would contribute an additional $100 million to a United Nations-backed multinational security force, as well as $33 million in humanitarian aid. And speaking to reporters in Kenya's Machakos County, Kituri Kindiki, Secretary of Interior and National Government Administration, said that the country is ready to deploy its trained police force to Haiti following the signing of a reciprocal agreement between the two nations.
All the other programs are in place, including the status of forces agreement and the laws on detention, arrests, and other enforcement measures are now in place.
Kenya announced last year that it would lead the force, but months of domestic legal wrangling have effectively placed the mission on hold. Earlier, I spoke with VOA Creole Service Chief Sandra Lemaire to get a clearer picture of the situation on the ground. Can you shed some light on what the situation in the ground is?
The gangs, I think, control closer to 90%. I think that's really the reality of the situation. Right now, the gangs have united, which before they were fighting amongst themselves, but they are now united in the cause of keeping the prime minister from returning to Haiti. And they say that they want to revolutionize the entire system of government of Haiti so that it's more caring for the people and giving people what they need. Because if you go into some of the poorest neighborhoods of Haiti, there's no running water, there's no sanitation, the living conditions are really horrendous. So they claim that that is one of the things that they are working towards. They are a financial power right now, whereas that wasn't true before, but they are now because of all the kidnappings that they've done. They have millions and millions of dollars.
With all that in mind, the average person who is just a citizen of Port-au-Prince or any of the other cities within Haiti, how is all this affecting them?
It's people are miserable. They're begging and pleading with the international community to please do something. They're begging their own local politicians to please get together and agree on something so that we can move forward. People are afraid to go to the market because the gangs could be fighting in the area. And, you know, whereas nothing was happening and you thought it was safe. We just saw video yesterday of a woman who was hit by several bullets and was just lying on the street and no one was helping her. If you're ill, for example, and you need to go and see a doctor, a lot of the doctors aren't going to the hospital to work. They've abandoned the hospitals because they say, you know, the gangs are coming in, they're shooting people up, and they just, you know, they're regular people too, aside from being medical officials. So they're staying home. So there's no healthcare right now. So it's just a matter of time. People are just in a situation that's really dire. And, you know, a lot of the NGOs have been saying this for a long time. I think sometimes people who, you know, don't really care that much about Haiti or only pay attention when there's something big happening, you know, they get tired of hearing the same old story, same old story. But this is really a case where, you know, the UN has said hundreds of thousands of people are going to go hungry if things don't change.
Sandra Lemaire is VOA's Creole Service Chief. Sandra, thank you so much for taking time out for us.
Thank you.
Now, still to come, we head to Washington to learn what drives a woodworker.
What is sculpture but dance, you know, in a moment in time?
This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. On Monday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for a truce in the Israel-Hamas war in the Gaza Strip and the conflict in Sudan as the holy Muslim fasting month of Ramadan begins.
I call on political, religious, and community leaders everywhere to do everything in their power to make this holy period a time for empathy, action, and peace.
He also called for the release of hostages held by Hamas and the removal of all obstacles to ensure the delivery of life-saving aid at the speed and massive scale that's being required to Gaza, where the United Nations has warned that a quarter of the population are on the brink of famine. Pramila Patton, a special representative of the Secretary General on Sexual Violence in Conflict, spoke during a meeting of the United Nations Security Council in New York on the conflict between Israel and the Palestinian Islamist group Hamas.
We found clear and convincing information that sexual violence, including rape, sexualized torture, and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, have been committed against hostages. And we have reasonable grounds to believe that such violence may still be ongoing against those in captivity.
Patton's team visited Israel between January 29th and February 14th on a mission intended to gather, analyze, and verify information on sexual violence linked to the October 7th attack. Palestinian militant group Hamas has repeatedly rejected accusations of sexual violence. Israel's military on Monday said that it had fired a missile into a residential building within the Gaza Strip, claiming Hamas militants were hiding in it. VOA has not been able to independently verify the claim, the location of the strike, or if there were any casualties. Also, Israel said it was still checking whether it had killed Hamas's deputy military leader in an airstrike in Gaza. Military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said that the targeted compound was used by, among others, Marwan Issa, Hamas's deputy military leader and one of the planners of Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel that sparked the Gaza War. But it was still not clear whether Issa had been killed. In Asia, China on Monday wrapped up an annual meeting of its National People's Congress. During the week-long gathering, China's top leader, Xi Jinping, further cemented his grip on power. We hear more from VOA's Bill Gallo.
A choreographed demonstration of Xi Jinping's growing strength. At a meeting of China's parliament, legislators endorsed decisions made by the Communist Party. Only a handful of delegates voted against any of the proposals. Here, the point is to portray harmony, not debate or dissent. Virtually everything we've seen here this week was very tightly scripted. In fact, it's hard to think of anything at all that happened that wasn't expected. But that reveals something important, how the Communist Party and Xi Jinping have dramatically expanded control over the state. At this closing session, delegates passed a law tightening party control over the government cabinet. The proposal passed 2,883-8. The cabinet is led by Premier Li Qiang. That position has been weakened to the extent that Li's annual press conference this week was canceled. Dolly Yang is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago.
The premier really has increasingly been playing a more of a coordinating role. So in essence, actually, it's a little awkward for Mr. Li to come out and be asked questions on the full gamut of things, when he cannot speak with as much authority on it.
Instead, the authority lies with Xi, who appears set to rule China indefinitely. And what Xi wants is a continued emphasis on national security, especially amid a slowing economy. Again, Dolly Yang.
When there are fewer jobs, in particular, available, clearly many people are becoming frustrated. And of course, that means that the leadership and the leaders of really across the hierarchy of the Chinese party state are much more aware of the challenges and trying to preserve stability.
This week, delegates passed several measures expanding punishments against those who threaten the party's rule. China calls this whole process democracy. It's also a system that is increasingly ruled by just one man. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Beijing.
Reuters News is reporting that soldiers backed by police, the intelligence service, the Air Force, and a local vigilante group are searching for armed kidnappers who abducted nearly 300 pupils from a school in Nigeria's northern Kaduna state. The Nigerian army has not responded to a request for comment, but David Doyle of Reuters News has this update.
Parents say they're waiting for answers from local authorities following the kidnapping last Thursday in the town of Kuriga. Such mass abductions were first carried out by Boko Haram a decade ago, but the tactic has since been adopted by armed gangs seeking ransom. Families and communities find themselves forced to pool their resources and sell prized possessions such as cattle and land to free their children.
Reuters' David Doyle. And finally, Jeff Swigart brings us the story of Marjorie Goldberg, a wood sculptor and gallery owner in Washington who's been heavily involved in the city's arts community for decades.
My first sculpture class was in Rochester, New York, when I was 10 years old. It was at that moment that I knew who I was and what I was going to do. Art is it's kind of an expression of your soul, of your experiences. And I had been taking years of dance class before then, from the age of 4. So I really love dance and I really love sculpture. You know, I mean, what is sculpture but dance, you know, in a moment in time? when I came to Washington and GW, and it was really the revolution years, 68 to 72. I have always been a truth to power person. I have never been afraid to speak my mind loudly, where I got my nickname in college, which is Megaphone Margie. You know, I did art, I did dance. I was very interested in Eastern religion. I figured I'm going to spend my life in art, so I want a well-rounded degree. And your art is only as good as your life experiences. One of my clients was the National Association of Home Builders, and they put out a statistic that said within 5 years, 50% of all carpenters are going to be retiring. It is the most endangered trade in this country and in Europe. We wrote a grant to build a mobile wood shop.
If this is spinning this way.
And to train a new generation of carpenters.
Whoa, that's so good.
What we often do is teach young kids how to turn things on a lathe, which they just adore doing. But I just felt that most schools don't have wood shops anymore. And they need a trade. I mean, I know the percentage of kids that went to college from my high school, 98%. There isn't one school in the city that would even come close to that. Tonight there's classes here in our stationary wood shop. It was just something that I really had wanted to do and felt there was a need for the city. We really built something.
The story of Marjorie Goldberg, brought to us by Jeff Swikard. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. And on behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, videos, stories, and a whole lot more, be sure to follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After more than a decade of progress fighting chronic hunger and malnutrition after the 2009 global food crisis, a series of unprecedented shocks have reversed many of our gains, including COVID-19, said Dina Esposito, assistant to the administrator for the U.S. Agency for International Development's Bureau for Resilience, Environment, and Food Security. The war in Ukraine, ongoing conflict in Sudan, Ethiopia, Yemen, and now Gaza, means that today 735 million people are chronically hungry, said Ms. Esposito in recent congressional testimony.
That's 120 million more than in 2019, pre-COVID. 140 million people in the most vulnerable countries are acutely hungry. They are victims of conflict or compound crises that have upended their livelihoods, and they must depend on humanitarian assistance to survive.
At the height of the global food crisis in 2022, USAID was able to provide nearly $20 billion in humanitarian assistance, of which $6 billion was for emergency food assistance, explained Ms. Esposito.
Beyond making our dollars stretch further in emergency situations, we must continue investments that we know prevent hunger in the first place, investments that have had meaningful success. In the areas where Feed the Future, the U.S. government's signature global hunger initiative, has worked, poverty, hunger, and child stunting all declined by 20 to 25% in its first decade of work.
But we do not rest on these results, declared Ms. Esposito. In 2022, with a doubling of their annual budget, USAID undertook a massive effort to harness Feed the Future to feed the present.
As food prices hit record highs following Putin's invasion of Ukraine, we rushed to get high-quality seeds, fertilizer, and financing to the markets and into the hands of some of the world's poorest farmers, helping absorb the worst effects of the food crisis by strengthening local production.
Without American leadership, global food security would be far worse, noted Ms. Esposito. Looking forward, bending the hunger curve downward will require us to better anticipate rather than only react to future shocks and continue to make long-term agricultural investments, enhancing our own economic well-being and fostering a safer and more secure world in the process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.